Today is Wednesday. It's June 8th, 2022, and it's 2:38 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Portions of this are broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the unimpressed publisher of the Picayune Sentinel newsletter and occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
What's not moving you?
I'm not moved by Lori Lightfoot's introductory video for her campaign.
She got
a 2-minute, 35-second video in which she sort of leans into this fact that she's seen as a very prickly mayor who infuriates people.
They say I'm tough.
Today, Mayor Lightfoot doubled down.
They say I get angry.
Lightfoot says she's had some tough battles.
They say sometimes I take things personally.
Delivered a tough one. The mayor won that show.
You know what I say?
The mayor met with
Chicago mayor Lightfoot.
They're absolutely right.
It's reminiscent of Rahm Emanuel's video from 2015, where he was talking about how he owns the fact that he rubs people the wrong way and he loses his temper. This seems like Lightfoot's attempt to replicate that. But I think she misread. Well, I'm doing a monologue here, but I think in this case, Lightfoot misreads what people think about her. That she says in the video, she says, they say I'm tough. They say I get angry. They say sometimes I take things personally. And then she says she takes things personally for the city. That doesn't make any sense. And that's not what they say about Lori Lightfoot. They say that she's touchy, that she's vindictive, that she's thin-skinned, that she's petty, and that therefore she's unable to lead to build coalitions to get things done that need to be done in the city because she is not an effective leader. And we've spoken about this on this podcast before, that yelling and screaming and losing your temper and sulking are not signs of competent leadership. And I don't know if this is going to sell or not. It worked for Rahm Emanuel. He won 56% of the vote in 2015 in that runoff election with Chuy Garcia. I think that has a lot more to do with the fact that Garcia ran a pretty lame campaign and that the opposition just wasn't very strong. If Lori Lightfoot gets another weak opponent and she makes the runoff, she may well win again. But I don't think it's going to be on the strength of her saying that it's okay that she's not a particularly effective leader.
And Rahm Emanuel, I mean, famously was that way, extraordinarily prickly, type A, almost Wolf of Wall Street-esque in private. He was that way behind closed doors. He was not that way necessarily, certainly not to the extent that Lori Lightfoot is, in public, on the dais in the middle of the city council, getting into kind of tit for tats with aldermen at the level that Lori Lightfoot is. And I really think it's also a misreading of what she has to run on, which is people's trust in her as a leader and whether or not the city is better today than when she took office. And that's going to be her biggest challenge. But I suppose her strategy is going to be that all of the criticism levied against me is a criticism that is levied as a result of my, say, hard-nosed approach to solving the big problems mm-hmm. with our city. But the problem is that many of those problems have not been progressed in being solved during her tenure as mayor, and many have gotten worse.
Right, and there's also a point in this video where she sort of plays the race, gender, sexuality card.
Look, I get it. I don't look or sound like any other mayor we've ever had before. And I've had to fight to get a seat at the table.
And like so many in our city, I have to fight to have my voice heard. And again, I mean, I think that this misreads the situation where the city embraced her. They gave her 74% of the vote back
knowing full well that she was a gay woman of color.
She was a gay woman of color. So I don't buy that. I don't think she's being held to a higher standard. People are very frustrated about crime in the city. For the most part, they're frustrated about the way she's fought with the Chicago Board of Education and frustrated with the lack of progress she's made. They're frustrated that she promised to have an elected school board and then pulled back on that promise. They're frustrated with the fact that she promised not to have the city funded by fees and fines, and she hasn't followed through on that. I mean, there are a number of things that they're frustrated about. There's also some accomplishments she's going to be able to point to. And again, it's all going to depend, I think, on the quality of the opposition that she gets. I just, like I said, I'm not, I wasn't impressed with her rollout, and I'm not well, convinced that this is the, I mean, what else was she going to do though? Right. I mean,
there you go.
She had to lean into that, try to make her weakness into her strength.
I would get in front of it if I were her, because that's what the other guys are going to do. I'm a different focus group, guys. I thought, you know me, I consume all of my politicians through their media rollouts and campaign commercials, and I'm in. I'm like, good idea. She looks great. It's a dynamic open. Is that the post office that she's standing in, the room there, that great hall? I'm pretty sure it is. And the shot zooms in on her and she says, yep, that's me. You know, I'm the tough, prickly, defensive one who's impatient. And then they circle the word impatient because she wants to get it done for the city. And I know that there's some things she can't champion, but she does mention that our city was aggressive and on top of the pandemic to the degree a big city could. Maybe you disagree with that, but I think that's one thing she can sort of try and check as she goes out on the campaign, because it's not going to be the policing of the city or the violence. And to me, that's the elephant in the room. I thought it was well done, and I thought it took the right tack, that you might as well say the reason I get angry is because I care so much.
Of course I take it personally, for our city. I
mean, isn't that what abusive spouses say?
Like, I don't know.
The reason I yell and scream at you and throw cutlery around the room is because I love you so much. You know, I don't necessarily buy that. I think that the best leaders are more like, I mean, I think that a good model of leadership is someone like Barack Obama. You know, no drama Obama.
Well, but she's not. So, I mean, what's she going to do? Promise to be better? I mean, that ain't going to happen. Heck, the next day, today, she said that people that think that David Brown should be fired as the chief, the police superintendent, what was the line? Don't know anything about public safety or something. I mean, she got brittle all over again. That's who she is.
She wasn't that way during the campaign in 2019.
That wasn't a record to run against.
Right, but that wasn't the Lori Lightfoot that I saw, the Lori Lightfoot that I voted for twice.
Well, tell me that.
And I may vote for her two more times. I'm not ruling her out.
But tell me the difference. Tell me the Lori Lightfoot you used to know.
Oh, she was much calmer, very calm, very focused.
She wasn't mayor then.
Okay, but I expected to see a little of who she really was when she's campaigning. She was very firm, very solid, very in control. I was impressed with her from the first moment I heard her on Ken Davis's podcast. I mean, I thought a lot of Lori Lightfoot for a long time.
Yeah, me too.
This wasn't like an ill-considered move on my part. I just think that she has shown that she is not so far really ready to assume leadership the way you want someone to.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's an easy job. Why isn't she doing it better? But, you know, and I'm also not saying that she had it was a better way for her to roll out her campaign. She kind of had to do it. What else was she going to do, right? She could deny they're wrong. I'm not thin-skinned.
Those idiots.
I'm not angry. What do they know? So, nothing.
I think there is some poetic justice to the, or just maybe a poetic nature to that opening scene that is in the old main post office, which now, if no one's seen how that looks now, it's amazing.
It's one of the most
really beautiful.
It's the most fantastic interior space in the city.
I would agree with that. And it is gorgeous. And obviously the building itself is politically infamous for, as I tell people on my Zoom calls while I show them the building in the background, because our building is just north of it. Ed Burke saying, "Did we land the tuna?" That is about, of course, the old main post office. So she begins her ad in the belly of the tuna, so to speak, and that is Ed Burke shaking down that developer for property tax appeals business. And of course, she really made her hay as a candidate in 2019, railing against Ed Burke during that whole conviction, and obviously Preckwinkle's ties to Burke. In the same way, I suppose a critic could look at this and say she's standing in an empty downtown building, which is a huge problem still, and was a problem for many, many months in Chicago. That is obviously not all on the mayor. There are many businesses that weren't bringing employees back to work, but it remains the case that downtown still, for so many people, is not a place that they are returning to. And that is also part of her record.
What do you guys think the impact of her landing the casino is going to be? on the voters. She will probably try to play this as a great triumph. Labor seems to be very happy with her for having done the deal with Bally. So we have the casino where the Tribune printing plant is going to used to be. But are voters going to be impressed? Do voters say, yeah, we really wanted a casino in Chicago. This is a good thing. This is what I want for my city.
I can't imagine that one person would be swayed to a yes vote because Lori Lightfoot brought a casino to the city of Chicago. I cannot imagine a person who's on the fence and say, well, you know what? On the margin, Lori Lightfoot got the casino done. Because first of all, I don't think the casino is even going to be operational. Maybe they have that other River North site that's like the interim site that maybe is going to happen. I think the more likely thing is that there are probably some marginal voters, maybe those around the site itself, who will want to vote against her for bringing it to Chicago. So I think that is entirely, to your point on the unions, it is entirely an inside game. It was a massive giveaway to labor. It's not that dissimilar to how Ed Burke was shaking down the developer of the blighted and abandoned Old Main Post Office.
How so?
There's a huge pot of money, development corporation is going to give the sweetest deal to labor is the one that will be politically approved, with a tacit understanding that that labor organization will back the mayor. So if there's political muscle that comes from the Chicago Federation of Labor to back Lori Lightfoot, which I do not think by any means is guaranteed, I think they could very easily fall behind someone like a Cam Buckner, who CTU is definitely going to be behind. So I think she did that for a very specific reason politically. It's not for the broad Chicago voting public. It is probably for a very narrow set of labor bosses that could maybe move votes for her, but I don't even think that's guaranteed.
My read on the room has been that it's been nothing but heat on her for this deal, both the way it was negotiated and the fact that it's a casino at all. But I suppose if the thing was up and running and traffic wasn't a problem and crime wasn't a problem and it was pouring money into the city coffers, I mean, down the road, it might look like a good idea. But right now, I think it's a liability. I'd be hard-pressed to imagine her running much on that.
Well, it's just the can-do mayor aspect of it. Right. That how many years, 20 years, 25, 30 years that and certainly I've been around that they were talking about a casino for Chicago and nobody got it done. That there was all this talk. Everybody flapped their gums for years. And then Mayor Lightfoot came in and she got it done. And we have a casino. Now, that's vastly oversimplifying it. But there's your 30-second commercial right there. If you think it's going to sell with the voters, which is that, you know, we had decades of inaction on this and money was pouring out of the city into Gary and up to Waukegan and up to Wisconsin and now it's going to be in the city. This is one of those things where I think that you're right, Austin, to say that there are people who live around there who are going to be unimpressed and angry about it.
But no, to the point of I don't think any Chicago's lived experience is going to change as a result of the casino by the time that there is an election. And the lived experience that they do have from 2019 versus today is a city with where they're paying much higher property taxes in most cases. They're paying much more in fines and fees. The schools have certainly not gotten better. If anything, they've gotten much worse. And crime is on everyone's mind. That's the lived experience, I think, of many Chicagoans. And it has
humor
to do with
me
the
for
casino.
One second here, Austin. Remember last week you mentioned this report on academics and you said that the Decatur students were in the third grade, something like 9% of them were on grade. Is that about right?
Yeah, I believe the numbers were in Decatur, Black students were something 2% of Black students in Decatur were reading at grade level in third grade, which is they measure at that year because it's critical. It's a critical indicator of their performance the rest of their school life. And then I think it was like 16% of white students and maybe 9% overall. Yeah, it was quite dismal. And CPS is not in a totally different world than that by any means. It's the fact that we are graduating so many kids out of CPS with hardly, and this is most evident in the graduation rate of City Colleges of Chicago, which mostly are composed of CPS students, are not able to do college level coursework. And there's a lot of failure there.
What was the report? I wanted to look that up.
Yeah, I believe it's called Zero Accountability is in the title. It was published by WirePoints. I will take a look. It's so called an Indictment of Illinois' Public Education System. Is the name
did you
book.
Write it, by the way?
No, I did not write it.
Does it include Rockford and Peoria schools and Chicago schools and Naperville schools?
Yes, then? Yes. It includes many of those schools. So some of the examples, the percent of third grade students that can read at grade level, and these are 2019 numbers, by the way, these are pre-COVID numbers. In Chicago, only 30% of Black students in third grade can read at grade level. So 70% cannot. Waukegan, it's just 16%. Rockford, just 7%. Elgin, 11%. I mean, these are really, really tremendously sad.
I'm shocked to hear that. Maybe I shouldn't be. I would have guessed it was bad. I'm shocked to hear it's that bad. And then in each of those districts, I suppose, are white students performing above or below, say, the 50% mark?
No, I mean, here's the problem is, I mean, I was on a school board for a few years, and we talked about, obviously, the achievement gap is often discussed on racial lines in a school. So, wow, our school is not performing well. We have a 30% gap, for example, between white students' test scores and Black students' test scores. Decatur only has, say, a 14% gap in white and Black students' test scores, but they're all extremely low. That's not a great outcome when everybody is more equal but failing. So the point of the report generally makes is that there's really no accountability at any level of the system for these results, specifically at the administrative level, which there is an extraordinary amount of waste and abuse of that system. There are so many six-figure administrators in the state of Illinois. We spend more than any other state at the administrative level on schools, and it is not getting us good results.
So who is this on? Is this on the state superintendent of schools? Is it on the governor? If it's an administrative bloat, that's not on the unions. Where does WirePoints point the finger?
There's three factors. One is something called social promotion. So the fact that students move along in the system just in order to be with their peers, and there's never a point that says, hey, you didn't complete, you weren't at this level, so you're getting held back a grade. So that's one level. There's also a level of there's something to be said for the funding here. The state, it's not like the state funds schools based on your progress in educating these students. It actually funds the reverse. You will get more money from the state if you're failing more. And then also it sort of points to, at some level, there is a broken, and this is, people have studied this for decades, it's very difficult to do. But teacher evaluation is also a very, very difficult challenge. So, for example, in Decatur, when you have 9% of all third grade students who can't read at grade level, but evaluations are saying 99% of school employees are performing well, there's some kind of disconnect there. Of course, there's social factors, and so far too often teachers are. This is the problem we have with police officers as well. There's all the problems of the world are placed upon them to solve, which is completely unfair. But at every level of the system, it seems like from the state to the local district level, to the classroom level, something's not working.
Yeah, but it's funny to me or interesting to me that the first thing you cited was too many administrators making too much money. I mean, to me, I would have put parents, teachers, general economy and how that weighs on families' ability to provide for kids. And then somewhere you've got some, you know, redundant superintendent making $200,000, but I wouldn't put that on the top of the list. Are you telling me that's a serious factor?
It's about leadership, right? So if you take any failing business and you blame all of the, say, entry-level employees for the performance of the business, that would be unfair. It's the same thing in this case. If you are a superintendent of a failing school district making $300,000 a year to lead it to be better, and it's not getting better, if that single person is not accountable for the results of the district, who is?
Yeah.
I think they bear a great deal of responsibility.
If that was the private sector, then you'd say, okay, we're going to give you a baseline of $125,000 with bonuses up to $400,000, depending on how the district performs per year. And barring a scam where they cheat the scores, that would be an interesting way to compensate these administrators. You like that idea?
Maybe. I think there's actually, this is often a problem in Illinois government where you have essentially folks who add a lot of value are actually underpaid, and the people who add very little value are overpaid. And so usually at the bottom level, there's far too many overpaid people. And then at the tippy top, they're probably underpaid relative to what they could get in the private sector, for example.
How does this compare to other states?
On the administrative level, we are way out of whack. We spend over $1 billion a year as a state just on district level bureaucracy. And I think we have around 850, it's either 650 or 850 school districts across the state of Illinois. So we have many school districts just in one community. You'll have a district for the K-5 schools. You'll have a district for the middle school, and you'll have a district for the high school, all overlapping, all with their own administrators.
And you can never keep track of them when they say, well, we're in District 203. What is that? It's the same town.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And you compare that to a state like Florida that has one school district per county in the state. It's like 20 some districts. And their results are way better. And they are also educating students of color. And they are also educating low-income students to much greater effect than we are here in Illinois. When we compare ourselves on that district bureaucracy level, we are way out of whack. And this also ties to the pension problem. Like we talked about Chicago finances briefly. You can expect if you're getting, there are superintendents in Illinois who can expect lifetime payouts between $8 and $9 million just in pension benefits after getting a six-figure salary and retiring at age 55.
The Aurora Police Department says they cannot adequately staff the Pride Parade there this weekend and that it should be canceled. The Aurora Police say they should not have the Pride Parade in Aurora because they can't adequately staff it, which is a super coincidence because just last week, the parade organizers said that they would not allow uniformed police to march with them. Police in general, if not specifically Aurora Police, have not been supportive of their community, they say, and they said the very presence of the uniforms and guns causes such high anxiety among their members. The police turned down their compromise offer to wear t-shirts with the insignia. We talked to Gwen Ciesla, one of the parade organizers, and he told me on my show this week, or was it late last week, Pete? It was late last week, right? Yeah. He told us that it's the uniform that bothers them, not the people in the uniform. So we're not excluding police officers, but it's the uniform that makes us anxious. Now the people in those uniforms say that they're understaffed. Off-duty cops won't sign up for the overtime to do it. Go figure. They can't guarantee the parade safety. The city hasn't said if they're going to cancel it yet, or have they? This has just been handed to me. Today's Aurora Pride Parade update. This is from Tinas Vondelis, the Sun-Times political reporter. The city of Aurora, led by Mayor Richard Irvin, has revoked the special event permit providing the parade, prohibiting the parade from taking place. Wow. So they've canceled the parade.
I think that the radio convention requires you to rustle those papers. There we go.
This just in, today's Aurora Pride Parade update from Tinas Vondelis. The city of Aurora, led by Mayor Richard Irvin, has revoked a special event permit and is prohibiting the parade from taking place, citing the inability of the Aurora Pride Board to get enough cops. Organizers have already appealed this. It just seems so childish, this tit-for-tat with these guys.
It's clearly a tit-for-tat, and as we spoke about this last week, and I am very much on the side of the police department marching in uniform. I think that the parade organizers made a big mistake. In San Francisco, they've already compromised. They had a similar ban on uniformed officers, and now they're going to let a certain number of them march in the parade because they realize this was just a bad political move. On the other hand, I really don't like the idea that because the police, I mean, this was clearly a little snit on their part, right? And I understand it. They're saying, well, this group doesn't want us around. Okay, we won't be around. We're not going to have your parade then. But there is a sense I have of a government institution acting in a way that is discriminatory. They are discriminating based on viewpoint. On the right for these people to assemble.
So is the city
there's some fine points here with the parade and everything. I mean, I think they could rally if they wanted to in a park to protest, but there's still something about this that really is troubling. Do you guys agree that?
Yeah, I don't like the idea that if so, that'd be sort of, it's very close, if not directly aligned with something like we're going to have a parade that's against the local government. So the local government's not going to give us a permit to have the parade, which is a bad idea. We should never be doing that.
There's functionally no difference between that.
I get
all the nuance here, but it's still as point out, Austin, it's basically, if you boil it down, that's exactly what we have here.
If the Boy Scouts were marching, I'll bet they'd have enough cops to oversee it and guarantee the safety. It seems almost like the city is a witting or unwitting pawn in the mayor's effort to be governor. This is like almost a campaign plank for Richard Irvin, and they're doing his bidding.
Yeah, I mean, he gets media saying that he's standing up for police and takes basically no, I don't think there's any downside for him doing that. I think even probably the people of Aurora agree with him by some degree, which just reinforces Eric's point of how bad of a political move this was by the organizers. I mean, they didn't need to pick this fight in the first place.
I know that, but who didn't need to pick this fight?
Who? The organizers themselves.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Here's a statement from them. To all our participants and sponsors, you're likely aware the police department said it can't get enough security. We have not been able to close the gap. As a result, our permit is now revoked. However, we're not giving up. Our position has been misrepresented, and we're making every effort to keep the parade as scheduled. So we'll see what their next step is. I don't know if they can appeal this to a court or how that happens. But, you know, if they don't get a lot of security, or if the police aren't very enthusiastic about providing for the safety and security of the parade, and something happens. I mean, I wonder what the smart thing to do is now, because this has become a flashpoint where it didn't have to be. And heaven forbid something bad really happened there. Bad things have happened at parades. So I'm wondering if maybe it is smart to cancel the thing now, given the point in time where we are. I know it's an important cause, but this is a parade. There's other ways to celebrate or get your point across. Let's not generate a place where something bad can happen, Eric.
And now I'm feeling like a pox on both their houses.
Yeah.
That I thought the parade organizers were wrong, and now I think the police department is wrong. And what was the word you used? Childish, John, to describe this?
It's like juvenile.
It's a little sandbox fight, and it's fairly ugly. Probably going to be on the national news. So
you think so? Maybe, is this a big deal?
I think it will be. I definitely think it will.
And how does that? And wonder what the world will say about this, because I think both sides are behaving badly. I would say the first domino, though, was struck by the parade organizers, who said that you can wear your T-shirts, but you can't have your uniforms there. That, I think, is such a bad message to send. And I don't buy that thing that it's not about the person in the uniform. It's about the uniform. Come on.
I think it will be, if it goes to a national level, it'll be filtered through kind of a partisan lens on both sides. So I think the story from MSNBC will be that Republican mayor who says all lives matter shuts down Pride Parade during Pride Month for his red meat base. And then the Fox News story will be Pride organizers who want to defund the police, yada, yada, yada. So I think all of it. In other words, just listen to Mincing Rascals and we'll have a nuanced take on this whole thing and just ignore those other stories.
Well, for evidence that the LGBTQ movement still has a hill to climb, one, I would say, need look no further than Chicago for other reasons. At that Mexico-Ecuador-friendly soccer match last Sunday, attended by 61,000 people, the same night that the Cubs drew 31,000, by the way, against the Cardinals, this soccer match at Soldier Field, some of the crowd began chanting a gay slur. This is all new to me, but I guess it's not uncommon at soccer matches, apparently especially so at matches featuring Team Mexico.
Did they chanting at the Mexican team? Or
No.
First of all, I highly recommend if anyone gets a chance to go see Mexico play at Soldier Field, it's electric. It's really fun. A lot of people come out. It's very passionate. But one of the downsides, and this has been the case for many, many years, and many different organizing bodies in soccer have tried to stop it, but Mexico fans will not be tamed on this, it seems. Basically, when the other team's goalie is kicking a goal kick onto, you know, to the other side of the field, there's a big lead up, whoa, and then they yell it when the ball is struck. So it's basically the equivalent of, like, we want a pitcher, not a bellyacher, for soccer, and a lot more offensive to people.
And the idea is that they're questioning the masculinity of the
yeah.
goalie. It's not yeah. Is it a direct
But they're
slur?
Not saying it about that individual per se.
It's like booing a team saying something that is quite offensive and is a slur. But yeah, it's in the team's general direction, yeah. the opposing team.
And so it's not really a chant, it's a cheer, so that you can't. So that if someone in the audience, it'd be hard for them to pick out somebody. If someone were chanting this word over and over again, they could pick him or her out and eject them. But this is shouted several times during the game, but not consistently or constantly. So you can't necessarily. And if you worried, there would be like 1,000 people who said it all at once. So you couldn't kick them all out at once. Is that
yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
This is from the Sun-Times story the next day. Tour organizers have tried to stamp out the chant. Visitors outside of Soldier Field were greeted by displays warning about that behavior, and a tarp covering the center circle before the game had a similar wording. People who bought tickets were emailed a warning not to use the chant. There were public service announcements over social media. Fans using the slur outside the arena were denied entry, and Mexico star Andres Guardado delivered a message before kickoff. Those efforts weren't enough. 81 minutes in, the chant came up and they stopped the match. And then the big scoreboard has a message saying, the reason we've stopped is because of the chant that you just heard. And now both teams then gathered at the center, and then they had about a 10-minute timeout. There's three tiers of punishment, or there's a protocol that has three tiers. This was tier one, so they paused the game. And then if it reared its head again, then they could actually stop the match right there. So one of the spokesperson for the tour said, we learned that it's going to take some time. We have to go back and evaluate the protocols, but we feel very strongly about the messaging and the education. The goal is to eradicate the chant, but we have to do it all together, not just organizers. We'll get it done. And by the way, this was the same week that at a White Sox-Tampa Bay Rays baseball game, it was Pride Night in Florida, and the Tampa Rays players had hats on that had their insignia color-coded like the rainbow flag. And five of the players said, we're not going to wear it. And one of them then spoke for the five and said, you know, we love these people. We're not trying to discriminate against them in any way. But it's very personal when you ask me to wear a garment that reflects something that is counter to my personal religious views. So I'm for you, but I can't wear the hat. It looks hypocritical to me.
Hypocritical?
How hypocritical? In what way?
Well, maybe hypocritical is the wrong word then, but I don't think you can have it both ways.
Oh, I see what you mean.
That's saying not an expression
that we
love
them,
of love.
But not,
yeah. That's yeah. You do not support them. You deny them when you find their meme or their image so repulsive that you can't wear it on your damn baseball hat, for crying out loud.
I don't know if it's repulsive. It does make not just a social but a political statement when you're asked to wear some sort of insignia. And the truth is that in a cosmopolitan area like Chicago, gay rights, gay marriage are no longer particularly controversial, and we all embrace, I think, gay equality and equal rights, opportunities, all that stuff like that. There are certainly segments of the population, and not inconsiderably small, that don't feel that way. They feel that this is wrong, that it should be discouraged, and that this is their cultural and religious belief. And you know, I think it's fine to argue about that on the political level. It's a fine line here when you're asking athletes to wear insignias or things on their uniforms to express solidarity with a point of view that they may not agree with. I say socially, religiously, and so it might make sense for pro sports teams not to engage in this kind of stuff at all, like not to make them wear camouflage uniforms on Veterans Day and when they do things like that, that they're just like, put on, have a uniform and leave the political symbolism. And I feel the same way, frankly, about the national anthem before games. I mean, I supported Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand for the national anthem. I support the San Francisco Giants manager wanting to stay in the clubhouse during the national anthem in a protest. I think that's fine. I would rather actually that sports venues not be venues for political statements, social statements that are like that, because they just do tend to be divisive.
That's interesting, Eric. I don't even like the pink bats and hats for Mother's Day or Breast Cancer Awareness Day, but they take up that cause. I agree with you about the camo gear. I would prefer they just wear their uniforms and stop using these guys as vehicles for, albeit good causes. But I also feel that the LGBTQ issue is such a basic fundamental right that they're championing.
The other factor here is the Pulse nightclub shooting, which happened in Orlando, is sort of in the territory of that team. So in some sense, it's also a statement of, remembrance for those lives lost. So it does carry an added weight that is maybe extra meaning outside of political.
And they've been ahead of issues like this for a while. They've been doing this for 15 years in Tampa, having a Pride night.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Pride night for the Bulls this year, and I don't recall whether the players had anything on their uniforms designating as Pride night. There were certainly a lot of bread and circuses around that concept during the game, but I don't think it was on the uniform. And it's different asking your players to represent something than it is to have the team make a statement. If the Tampa Bay Rays want to have a rainbow flag on their flagpole and rainbow flags on the top of the dugout and so on, I think that's a little different. And again, I mean, I'm totally behind the symbolism of the rainbow flag, but I try to look at it conceptually and say, what if it were, say, Black Lives Matter, which is more controversial than the rainbow flag? Would that be something that you could say, well, players have to wear a Black Lives Matter patch on their shirt? It's one of those things where when you start like asking where's the line, mm-hmm. you start thinking, well, maybe the line should be, breast cancer awareness is not, I don't think, particularly controversial in any circles, but there, a lot of these other things are controversial. And do you want to make individual players have to make a statement about a controversial issue, even if you think they're dead wrong?
I would reinforce the fact that in some ways this backfires, right? Because then the media coverage about sort of the genuine effort to support the LGBTQ community becomes a story about four or five players who don't feel comfortable wearing a rainbow flag. It highlights more that there is opposition to this rather than having a general statement of support at a game. I do think there are sometimes unintended consequences to this.
Did you notice that the Naperville school board said that next year they're going to tweak their, maybe they already have, but we haven't seen it yet, but they're tweaking their dress code for the students. They're going to make it uniform for the entire district rather than school by school. And one of the things that they already said is that they are going to allow hats and head coverings as long as they don't keep us from recognizing who the student is and as long as it's not disruptive to the educational process. So I'm this is why you don't want to be on a school board, right, Austin? Because now you've got to decide what is or is not disruptive to the educational process. And I'm thinking of all the things that are on hats, kind of like we're dressing up the baseball players for certain causes here. What if the hat is a camo hat? What if the hat is a MAGA hat? What if the hat is a Black Lives Matter hat and somebody's annoyed enough at that they now have disrupted my educational process? You can just see that rearing its head, right? So the only kind of hats, and I don't even know if they make these, they're probably going to be able to allow are, white hats, green hats, blue hats, black hats.
Undercover cop hats.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just wearing a cap. Nothing funny going on here.
What if you have a cap, and I know that they sell these with a Confederate flag on it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very much in what I'm talking about here. So, what, Eric? I've just appointed you president of the school board. Are you going to allow these hats that we've just described?
Well, of course, the problem is, and the Tribune did a wonderful long takeout on school dress codes in Chicago maybe 2 weekends ago, and it talked about all the difficulties they have in respecting cultural values and religious values in dress codes. That you, it's easy to say, well, you got to wear a uniform and it looks just like this and period, that's it. But then there are certain faiths that require head coverings of some sort. And you have, so you have to allow for that. And then once you allow that kind of head covering, well, who's to say you can't have like a do-rag, which is tends to be identified with African-Americans, but is saying boys can't wear a bandana on their heads because why? And then suddenly you're into other kinds of statements, and they've had this having to do with hairstyles and braids and cornrows and things like that. I think most of those are in the past, but there are all these. And then, of course, you say, well, let's just open it up. And it sounds like you'll let everybody do what you want. But then you have things like, well, you have gang colors and there's gang identification.
Yeah, that's where this the issues you're talking about
where you go, what if you got a T-shirt or a hat that has a message that's, you know, it's not necessarily openly racist or hostile, but it's got some real edge to it. It's got, you know, the NRA or. Yeah. Or some double sure. entendre meaning. This is why I guess I'm glad I'm not on a school board. Also, and Austin, you didn't run again, did you?
No, it wasn't an elected. It was more like a school council. Like it wasn't any kind of elected thing. But yeah, this is very, very tricky. You sort of have to. It's not that dissimilar than. Hey, every high school has that kid who wants to wear a T-shirt that's completely inappropriate just to freak people out, right? I mean, yeah. that's been a thing since time immemorial, you know? Like, so there's the problem with this is that there's always the extreme cases that test the limits of it, and then it gets so much media attention, and it's such a hullabaloo. But the more I think about this issue,
what's the matter, Austin? What's troubling you there, young man?
The more I think about this issue, the more I'm in favor of more traditional dress codes in schools, which is something I would not have thought maybe 10 years ago. And certainly not when I was in school, I would have hated that. But it just takes so much of the guesswork out of what kids have to think about every day, honestly.
The Tribune story talked about that some parents were not happy with uniforms because they were expensive or something. Most of the uniforms that I've seen, like at Shurs High School in my neighborhood city, it's basically like white shirts and dark pants or skirts. And students do whatever they can to try to dress this up, right? With shoes or socks or anything. They want to be distinctive in some ways. But that I think, I mean, my read of the literature on this is that most parents are more pleased with uniforms than they are with this constant struggle that the kids have to keep up with fashion, or to dress appropriately. That there's all kinds of stuff in this article about young women who are more developed than others and they can't show cleavage, and women and young women who are less developed, no one worries about their plunging necklines. And I mean, it's all sorts of just nonsense. And you're thinking about, like, here's a principal who is tasked, as Austin was talking about earlier in this podcast, with these low reading scores and all these other challenges. And all of a sudden they've got to deal with, like, how short someone's skirt is or whether their spaghetti strap is wide enough. And it's just like, it's unbelievable. So yeah, I'm kind of with Austin on this. Like, maybe that is the best of a bunch of bad solutions to this, is just say, hey, you know what? Wear a white shirt and dark pants and dark shoes and come to school and get the job done and then go home and express yourself all you want off of school time.
One last topic. Speaking of schools, Eric, you and I talked about this a little bit on the radio, and I asked my audience about it as well. Should the audio and the pictures from the Uvalde shooting be made public? I've been a no on that. I did watch today the testimony before Congress. Raja Krishnamoorthy, the Chicago area Democrat, was one of the people on that panel. Anyway, we haven't seen the pictures, though, and we haven't heard the audio. And the question is, should we? Incidentally, my audience, this is, you know, non-scientific. They just click through if they want to respond. But 40% said, yeah, show the video or pictures and play the audio. We have to try and shock some sensibility into these Republican senators.
I have long been against the automatic release of 911 audio recordings because I feel like it's really invasive. It shows people or reveals people at their absolute worst moments. And when you're calling 911, you're not thinking, well, I'm providing entertainment for the viewers of WMAQ and the listeners of WGN when I'm doing this, or you know, CNN. I mean, this kind of audio goes all over the place, and it's horrifying, unless the person who makes the call consents to the release of the recording, in which case I'm fine with it if that's what they want and that's what the media organizations want. I would say the same thing is true of crime scene photos. But there is no tradition at all that I know of in American media to show crime scene photos. That these are, I presumably you could subpoena them, get a look at them, but the media doesn't show airplanes flying into the Twin Towers. So it's not going to show dead bodies in a classroom, unless something really changes here. And I'm of a mixed mind about whether seeing those images with consent of the parents would change anybody's mind, or just be so repulsive and so horrifying that people just wouldn't want to think about it. I don't know.
I would be okay with their release to the committee. I would be okay with the lawmakers seeing them.
In general, I think it's... we have to almost remove ourselves from the content as much as possible and just think of it as a basic government transparency issue. And I think when we do that, it's clear that if people request to have these, they should get them. They're public property. And in this case, you would have to think things like footage might be important in revealing what actually happened, especially when you have the local head of police refusing to cooperate with investigations into how his department was handling all of this. So I think in that sense, it would be a public benefit in order for people to see that. Now, whether media institutions or companies or people or whoever should share those horrifying images, I think is a different question, maybe more of a moral question. But in terms of should they be compelled to release these, if a citizen asks for them, I think I would say yes.
Boy,
I could imagine a kind of a compromise situation where you could say, yes, the media can listen to these recordings. Yes, the media can see the footage, can see the photographs, but we're not going to release it. They have to do it in a private room, and they have to leave their recorders and equipment outside the room. They can look at it all they want to evaluate it, and then they have to leave it in there. Because you know, we just don't want those images out there. I don't think, like I said, I don't think that newspapers and magazines or TV stations would show those images, even if they got permission, for the most part. It's probably important, though, for us to really get a sense of how terrible the destruction is when someone is shot by these AR-15 style rifles. These are weapons that do incredible amounts of damage, and there's a question we have to ask about what kind of access should people have to those weapons, under what circumstances. Those are good questions to ask. I don't know that seeing those images would sway a sufficient number of voters or senators to change things. As I've said before, I think right now we're at a point where people are just like so frustrated, so desperate to have any action taken, that they're looking for anything that might move the needle, since nothing else seems to.
And it does seem to be doing that right now, doesn't it? Do you get the sense that at least the Senate is, they may not change a lick, but it seems like they're at least more engaged in the process than they've been in the past. I'm hopeful that they'll raise the age past 18 to 21. That probably won't happen. Close the gun show loophole, close the internet loophole. No one's subtracting guns from the pipeline. They're not going to come and get your guns. It will, at worst, be a minor inconvenience for you to pretty much still get the same weapons you were going to get if some of these measures were enacted. But you'd make it sound like they're going to strike the Second Amendment from the Constitution. That's not what these modest efforts are all about.
I did think that in terms of effective messaging, Matthew McConaughey's speech to the White House press corps was pretty astounding, and should be, I think, a lesson for anyone who wants to see policy action taken in the wake of a tragedy.
May they wore green high-top Converse with a heart she had hand-drawn on the right toe because they represented her love of nature. Wore these every day. Green Converse with a heart on the right toe. These are the same green Converse on her feet that turned out to be the only clear evidence that could identify her after the shooting.
have that.
Specifically, his skin in the game, first of all. I mean, he was born in that community. His family went there the day after it happened, clearly spoke in detail to a lot of families personally. He shared the stories of all of those individuals in a really graceful way.
Yeah.
He respected very much their faith. He respected very much their right to own guns responsibly. And it was sort of a plea to rise above divisive forces and focus on what people can agree upon. And I think in terms of, and then he very briefly mentioned some of those reforms, right? Raising the age from 18 to 21. I think maybe some background checks, policy reform. I can't remember the others, but just the way that that was delivered was so far in a way more effective than, for example, taking a video of yourself screaming at Ted Cruz in a restaurant, and will appeal to some part of the Republican base.
Yeah, I was wondering if any of the Republican senators, I mean, that's who we're talking about, right? I mean, this whole conversation, isn't it? Don't you guys get the feeling that this entire conversation is about persuading 50 men and women? That's what this is. And I thought, well, I wonder if they're watching that. The first time I saw, I didn't know that he was going to speak, and I had CNN on, and then I saw Matthew McConaughey speaking. And then I saw he was speaking from the same lectern that the White House press corps gets their briefings. And I thought, oh, I'm not so sure if that's the right place for him to speak on behalf of the administration. Not in support of, but from that podium, it's on behalf of the administration. And he's Matthew McConaughey, for crying out loud. The longer he talked, the more powerful and appropriate it seemed to me, particularly since he personified these numbers. He was telling these children's stories and holding up pictures, and I don't think he was being over emotional, but it was an emotional presentation. Now, I haven't heard what Ron Johnson has had to say about that.
Another a good example is, I mean, Fox News had him on later. He was on Bret Baier's show saying many similar points, speaking directly to Republican voters in a way that transcended the divisive rhetoric on this issue.
Yeah.
And I think that was impressive.
Just one last note about this, guys, and then we can wrap this up today. But Neil Steinberg, who sometimes visits with us here on the Mincing Rascals, is a columnist who writes books and is regular in the Chicago Sun-Times. He's on page 2 today, Why Restrict Child Porn But Not Guns. I don't know if you saw that piece or the photo that is with it. It's a really amazing photograph of a man displaying his gun collection in front of his house with his children. But then Steinberg just says, we have the First Amendment, which we cherish, and yet we are happy with restrictions we put on it, including child pornography is a restriction in spite of the First Amendment freedom of speech. He says, why then do we stop with the Second Amendment? We get to the Second Amendment, we say the right to own guns when they harm children the same way child pornography harms children, and we're okay with restrictions in the First Amendment, why not some restrictions in the Second Amendment when children are easily the target? I'm not maybe doing that article justice, but if you read it, I thought he made a really clear and compelling constitutional argument to restrict some gun rights.
I read that piece, and it's typical Neil Steinberg, which is brilliant. But what maybe I think was that when you have the Second Amendment, there are limits on it. You can't just go out and buy a machine gun, for instance, or a bazooka or shoulder-fired missile or something like that. There are limits. They're just not very effective or strong limits. And so we do need to accept that, yeah, we do have limits on the Second Amendment. And there are also age restrictions. There are restrictions on the Second Amendment rights of people who've been convicted of violent felonies. There are all kinds of little restrictions. I think we need to think about expanding those without saying that by expanding them, we are necessarily obliterating the Second Amendment. Just like when you expand anti-child pornography laws, you're not destroying the First Amendment. You're saying, look, there are some limits on the First Amendment, and the First Amendment is basically extremely robust still. The Second Amendment can remain robust if we say, just for instance, something you talked about earlier, restrict the purchase of AR-15 style weapons and those kind of, you know, quote unquote assault rifles to people who are 21 and older. that doesn't seem like it's going to damage the Second Amendment in a way that's should be terrifying to anyone.
Yeah.
So I mean, I thought that his point was good, but that the Second Amendment does, we already have limits on it. We just need to expand those limits in a creative way that doesn't make everybody wet their pants.
That's a better summary of it. He didn't say wet their pants in the article, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, sometimes have standards.
So. All right, fellas, any last words of wisdom you want to lay on us here before we wrap it up today?
We got through this entire podcast without once mentioning the race for governor, which people are going to vote in less than 3 weeks on that. But,
has much changed on that? Because except that there's a new commercial that I saw.
There was a new poll that was released by Dan Proft, who is running a PAC against basically a pack attacking Richard Irvin, showing that Darren Bailey has taken the lead. That's the most recent statewide poll that we have. I think it's like a five or six point lead on Richard Irvin, followed by Jesse Sullivan and Gary Rabine. But other than that, I think no real tremendous change in that race.
Are there other polls that support that one? Is that real? Do you think that Bailey is in fact
in the lead? The only statewide that I've seen. And then according to the campaigns I've talked to, they say that kind of reflects what they're seeing internally. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that Bailey is at the very least neck and neck.
There wasn't a lot of drama. I watched the debate on last Thursday night. There wasn't a lot of drama there. All the candidates were on stage for the first and I think only time during this campaign season. And the others went after Irvin, and Irvin ducked and dodged the way he usually does. And when you have 1 hour debate, when you've got six candidates trying to talk, then it's going to be kind of a mess. And it was not particularly enlightening. And it also didn't air during prime time. It aired at 10:30 at night on Friday on Channel 7. I just don't think that many people watched it. So more people by far are being exposed to these commercials. And it looks like Bailey has the money not to keep up necessarily with Irvin, who has $50 million, but he has enough to keep his face and his voice and his message that Irvin is just a Democrat in Republican clothing in front of the voters, which is, I think, damaging him.
Well, they both have billionaires behind them, but Ken Griffin has spent more money on Richard Irvin. It's $50 million plus now. And I don't know if, Austin, this is the sort of thing you would probably come up with, but I wonder nationally when you had a sort of third-party benefactor financing your campaign, what's the most money anybody has ever spent on a losing candidate? Is Ken Griffin going to set the record for futility and dollars spent on the Richard Irvin campaign if he doesn't even get out of the primary?
I don't know about third-party, but I think Bloomberg kind of probably blows away the field in his presidential run. That was something like $200 million, something crazy like that on his campaign, where he got, in terms of dollars per vote, was probably the most ever spent.
And there've been some really expensive Senate campaigns in California, but I don't know what the dollar figure is.
Yeah, I want it from one individual donor. Austin's got a lot of work to do here, but I want one individual donor's futile campaign dollars spent. Who wins? And it can't be on yourself.
You're saying futile, but it could be the investment could pay off, right? Irvin could win. I'm not sure why it's worth $50 million to Ken Griffin for Irvin to win.
I know. It's like, how angry at JB are you? Dude, didn't we just go up two notches on our credit rating? I mean, yeah. I understand why you don't like JB Pritzker and the way he does things and your politics are different, but you're a billionaire. Is this worth $50 million to you? You're going to be fine.
If I were Griffin's kids, I'd be like, oh, man, my inheritance. No. Going down the
drain. Well, this is how I felt about Oberweis. How much money did Oberweis spend on the ice cream magnet in the Chicago area? He was always running for something and spending a lot of money on it. And I'm like, Dad, how many ice cream cones are we going to scoop here before there's no more money left? Stop it already. All right, that's it. We're done. That's Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. That's Eric Zorn. Oh, by the way, Eric, I want to do a better job of telling people how to either catch Austin's movie or watch or read Eric's column. So, Austin, what's the blurb I need to start using for you?
So you can go to freetocarefilm.com, and then you can also listen to my podcast, America's Talking, which is on every platform.
And I got to put that in the front of this podcast. And then, Eric, for you?
Well, my Picayune Sentinel newsletter comes out every Thursday, and you can search for Picayune Sentinel online, or you can write to me at ericzorn@gmail.com, and I will gladly add you to the mailing list.
We are produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Talk to you guys soon.
Okay, boys.
Thanks, John.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.